Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Bento Box and Clover, working together to provide restaurants with even more technology for a better hospitality experience. Visit getbento.com/better to learn more.
Traditionally, we chat with restaurant entrepreneurs who are in the process of building, catching a glimpse into the process and challenges that unfold during opening. Today, we're fortunate to be having a conversation from the other side as our guests are approaching their one-year anniversary.
Our guests today are our fellow husband and wife team, which you all know we love, Chef Jenner Tomaska and Katrina Bravo of Esme in Chicago. They met the good old-fashioned way, just like Alex and I, working at a restaurant. They've earned a Michelin star in their 1 year at Esme. Congrats. And it's their first venture together, prior to which Jenner was the chef at Next and Katrina worked in marketing for the Alenia Group. So welcome and congrats on your first anniversary.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So you made it a year. How does it feel?
It's still a bit surreal. I feel like a lot of the times specifically in the restaurant industry and even in life, it's hard to stop and kind of enjoy the moment when there's always, something looming around the corner of work to do, but it feels good.
Feels good. So tell our audience who may not be familiar yet with Esme about the business and about the restaurant and what y'all are doing, what you're up to in Chicago.
Katrina, you want to do that one?
No, you can go.
It's your baby.
Yeah. So, I mean, Katrina and I have always kind of dreamed of opening a space together. We started, dreaming about this many, many, many moons ago. I love cooking and I love the, hospitality world. So obviously we wanted to open a restaurant and, when kind of deciding what our path was going to be, I do love the creative idea of the tasting menu, but it's not necessarily, something I want or would only do. I'd grill cheeseburgers. I just like the idea of crafting something for someone. So when we decided to choose this business model, I think it was very much so not the idea of, making the best restaurant, but, having purpose, whatever we were going to do. And I think, given COVID in the last several years, it's even more so imprinted why we wanted to do the restaurant, kind of how we're doing it. So to give you a little background on what the concept is, one side of the restaurant's a tasting menu, obviously. The other side's an a la carte bar. But the space is much more than that. It really is a kind of a platform for others, a jumping off point or a space to kind of be highlighted. So we're always being kind of inspired by others, right? Whether that is an artist or someone kind of actively participating in the community. For me, the art part is fun because, culinary arts and food kind of can go hand in hand. And to be able to be inspired by, kind of others' work is what we do here, right? So we rotate an artist quarterly or a philanthropic group quarterly and then showcase who they are, right? And then we kind of write a menu and create food around that. So it's this kind of ever-changing idea of food, service, and fun, right? Right now we're featuring an artist and some of the food is directly correlated to what her art, represents. Sometimes it's not so literal. Our next menu will be featuring Kitchen Possible. It's a youth programming group in the city and they're not a group of artists, but it's a program that I've been involved with a long time. We've come up with a whimsical way to kind of showcase who they are and make food with it and make it fun.
Yeah, and I think that something that we always knew we wanted to do these quarterly dinners that put us and our guests in the position to do something positive with their money. while dining out. But what we didn't really anticipate was, even when we're not running the quarterly dinners, like, we're very involved with, you know, all of our ceramists or the people helping us make our vessels, or even just the artists on the wall. And it's kind of evolved itself into, at every given point in time within our space, we're trying to help others, or we're working with others. So, you know, for example, with Courtney, whose art is hanging on our wall right now, like, if she sells a piece, we treat it like a gallery, but we don't take a percentage, right? So we feel like that is helpful for artists that we appreciate, because they get to see that money, that's their livelihood. It helps them continue to create, and it supports them. And then, you know, just the pieces that we're using, or our cutlery, you know, we send out these newsletters, which I try to keep them less about us and more about others, where we really just highlight all these amazing artisans and tell, you know, guests or subscribers, like, you can explore their work here. This is what they've done. This is what they're going to do. Like, buy their stuff if you want it for your house. Like, we've sold service pieces to guests like, we've packaged them and sent them home with them because they want to buy them. You know, we've had people who've commissioned artists that are, you know, Amanda Rivera, who did a mural in our bar and has art in our bathrooms, that guests have loved her work. We put them in touch. They've commissioned private pieces for their home. So I think that we always knew there was going to be a philanthropic element, and we, you know, that was what made sense to us. Like, our background, I always say we were raised by Michael, Lisa Cornick, and Eric Williams. Like, those three people are so influential to us in terms of who we are today. But we didn't anticipate this time last year just how much everything is about doing something for others. Even, you know, Tia, which I always say I never knew we needed this or we should be doing this. Like, she's created a beverage program where she's basically showcasing these amazing people who are doing great work, people of color, women-owned labels, or just generally things that their labels are giving back, you know, to different causes. So we really have tried to pay it forward in every respect. And I think that we've been quite successful in that, and just making connections with individuals. And that's really our background.
Very cool.
It sounds amazing. And we were just in Chicago and we partnered up. So we were regretful that we didn't get to see the experience, but we will see it soon. Take us back a little bit to the beginning, where it all began, and tell us a little bit about how you found the space and how you built the space and your timeline and some of those fun things about the build. And if you remember any of those things, or if they've all been blocked out now that you're
I'll take it. You know, everything happens for a reason. And I studied marketing and advertising, and the economy tanked when I moved here. I ended up in residential real estate. You know, and I remember many, many years of asking, like, why am I in this position? This is not what I want to be doing. But everything happens for a reason. And I was able to make some great connections. I really loved the company I was working for. Jenner and I were dating, then fiancéed and married, all while I was at this company. And so ironically, they also happened to own which I was working for them before Jenner and I got together, and living with them even longer than that. So they actually own the space where Next is. So just because a lot of the big wigs would come in and out of that space, they knew who Jenner was. And then I was promoted and was working more on the marketing and branding side downtown. And so, you know, it's like the normal, oh, when is your husband going to open his own restaurant sort of situation? And, you know, it's all been pretty kismet. And I was actually just thinking about this the other day. When I used to drive to MK, I would pass 2200 Clark, which is where our restaurant is now, every day. And I always looked at it because there are apartments above. It's owned by the same place I live. And I always looked and I was like, oh, and I looked to move there into those apartments a few times. And I would always stare into that restaurant or into that space. And I really don't know why. And I'm not trying to be like, you know, make this fairy tale, but I was just thinking about this. And probably like I don't know, 6 years ago, maybe, one of our project managers, one of the big guys, came over to me and they're like, you know, Jenner should put something at 2200 Clark. It's been vacant forever. This is while he was still at Next. And I'm like, no, you're crazy. Also, it's across from a school, so that's going to be impossible, like, to get a liquor license. So, you know, it was kind of put out there. I remember showing Jenner the plans because they sent them to me. And then when we decided to move forward, we were actually looking at other spaces. I left the Alenia Group. And while we were looking at other spaces to open Esme, I went back to my old company. I was like, I'm just going to go back to sales until we get this thing open. I was at a meeting, and again, like the team, like these were also the team that when Jenner left Next were the first people to take us out to lunch. Like they really wanted us in one of their spaces. So they, you know, Sam, God bless him, was like, what about 2200 Clark? Cause we had been looking at other spaces within the company and, you know, outside the company. And I was like, you know, there's no way. Like it's across from the school, you know, it's a very affluent school. Those parents are not going to let us do that. And he's like, we'll take care of it. We'll make it, we're going to make it happen. And everything happens for a reason, honestly, because this was not the path of least resistance. One, it wasn't built out the way we needed it to be. It's across the street from a school, a very affluent school in a very affluent neighborhood. You can't get a liquor license X, you know, distance from from a school. So it's why it was vacant for so long. It took us forever. We had to convince the alderman. We had to go to the neighborhood. We had to go to the school. Then we finally got all these approvals. And then the city said, yeah, we'll give you this liquor license. We did all this petitioning, went to like city meetings. And it just took freaking forever. And then finally, I remember we got everything we needed and we were looking at the space, and it turned out the space didn't have black iron. What's that going to mean for us? Oh, what is it? It was such a disaster. It was just like, this is never going to happen. This is never going to open. Why do all these obstacles keep coming up? We got past that one obstacle. I will never forget this because I remember walking home and crying, telling Jenner, like, this is impossible. Like, clearly we're not supposed to be opening this restaurant. Like, what the heck? We're about to sign this lease and we hear about a virus, and our business partner and Jenner are like, you know what? Let's hold on a second. Like, literally, we had the lease. Like, we had gone through all of this. I'm talking, this took 2 years and probably 5 years from the first time they ever even mentioned 2200 Clark to us. And Jenner always wanted that space. Also, like, unbeknownst to me, he always eyed that space too. And so we waited, and then we all got shut down. So everything got shut down. The whole world got shut down.
So you hadn't signed the lease. At this point, you hadn't signed the lease. You had just like gotten the steps that you needed to get it into execution form. Wow.
Oh yeah. No, it was actually.
I think it was like December.
No, it wasn't December.
Did you have some sort of a deal with the real estate owner of that you're committing all this time to trying to get the liquor licenses through without a lease? Like, what was that?
They were great. No, they were great. They were great. It was a very, because of my relationship with the company, because of Jenner, and because the space had been empty for so long, like they didn't hold anything. Like there was nothing, like they just were helping us out because it was beneficial to them.
Yeah. I mean, the conversation was fully like, and the negotiation one was like, yeah, well, you know, we can sign a lease, but we're not signing a lease if we can't get a liquor license, because there's not going to be.
Yeah.
So they're very understanding of that. And, you know, to be honest, like the ones that were pushing for it, because whether, you know, that costs money and things like that, but at the end of the day, it increases their property, you know, like they're investing into their own property. So they were open to kind of doing that.
They sent their attorneys with us to the council meetings. They showed up at the council, but they were wonderful.
And then right before COVID, we'd come across another issue. You know, we had done our initial drawings and things like that. And, we had it inspected a couple of times by our contractor, and, you know, they didn't do the best of job. And then the final kind of walkthrough, we decided to change contractors, before we signed this lease, you know, to make sure our budget was accurate and things like that. And the guy's like, there's no black iron in this space. What they're calling black iron is not to code. And it was only on the outside of the building. And for anyone who's listening, if you know, black iron's, you know, one of the most expensive things to, you know, that goes into a restaurant. It's basically the exhaust from the kitchen equipment to the outside, and, you know, running that you know, 50 feet, you know, to the outside of the building, and then 200 feet up vertically to the top of the roof, becomes quite expensive. And that's something we had thought was, you know,
in
the restaurant, we were going to only have to spend minimal, you know, dollars on to, you know, attach it, fix it. But it was basically like starting over. So we were kind of at a loss, and then Katrina was describing walking home and crying because
I was crying.
Yeah.
It's been 2 years.
Oh yeah. I was crying, and he's got the dates wrong because in February is when we finally figured everything out and we had that contract. Like, they sent the lease in February, and that's when our business partner had already been listening since January and was like, you know, and then February, him and Jenna were like, you know what? No, we're not going to sign this.
So you held up.
Yeah. So what happened is that, you know, COVID kind of happened, and then we actually signed a lease in the midst of the shutdown.
The same lease,
but it was amended because of COVID, right? So basically we said, you know, we're open to signing this lease and moving forward, because we wanted to, it's a gamble, right? We bought in the red, and you know, we have been very fortunate because of COVID. We were able to renegotiate the rent,
mm-hmm.
you know, renegotiate the, TI. You know, the TI, the rent abatement, all things that are vital for small business owners and specifically restaurants, because to not have to pay rent for a year to do the build out and then open for a month and get your feet under you is a big deal. You know, and to offset some of those costs that COVID was, you know, kind of affected us, and have a landlord that was supportive is a big deal. I'm sure if you ask around the hospitality world, you get two answers. Like, the landlord doesn't care. They want the rent. It's pay or get out. Or they are investing in who is investing in their property, right? Because I go into someone's property and I put money into it, and it basically raises the, you know, the overall stature of the building, and, you know, increases, you know, the net of the property, right? But some people aren't looking at it like that because of their own financial issues. So we're very lucky to have a landlord and kind of go about it the right way.
We were lucky for the delays, honestly, because had this been the path of least resistance, let's just say there was no school across the street, there was Black Iron, we would have built out and opened and been shut down. Like, right. That's basically what would have happened. Out. We would have had employees, we would have had a restaurant, we would have had investors to speak to, we would have been opening our doors, and we would have been shut down. So every single solitary thing that occurred ended up being for the best. Oh, and I also got pregnant during this. So I was also like,
I'm not laughing.
I also was like due when, like, one of our initial opening dates was March, and I was actually due March, and Jenna and I were like, yeah, it'll be fine. Oh my God. Thank God we got delayed past March. What was wrong with us?
It's so funny. We thought we had this all, like, this whole like thing mapped out in our heads and on paper, like, yeah, this kid's going to come here and our opening date's going to be here and so on and so forth. And plan for the worst and hope for the best. And that has been our mantra the whole time. And it's worked out.
You're one of the first COVID success stories in a way that COVID actually benefited the business. Al, what were you going to say?
I was just going to ask how long did it end up taking you to get from your amended lease signing until when you opened? Was it the year?
Just under. So I think we signed in what, March, Katrina? Like when, like, the official shutdown happened?
No, it was a year. No. So we officially signed, and we also kept raising money during the pandemic. Lord help. What can you imagine this? Like, my husband calling people like, do you want to invest in my restaurant? The whole world is shut down. Like, he was like, I'm halfway there. I'm not going to stop now.
Right.
But we signed.
Tell me about that a little bit. Did you, what percentage of your build out had you raised before you signed the lease, and how much did you anticipate to continue to raise?
So I think that's one of the biggest issues with the restaurant industry is this kind of competition, an ego driven competition, maybe at times. Like, there's not enough camaraderie and I think open vocal conversation from, it just shattered, like from all aspects, but in particular, like new business owners. Like I was very lucky to have Eric Williams, who had just opened a restaurant, Virtue in Hyde Park, and him be supportive in a way where like he openly talked to me about the ins and outs of how to do this. Right. And didn't necessarily like, he almost wrote like the play, like didn't write it for me, but like I got to read the playbook on how to win the World Series.
Right.
Before going into, you know, the 7 games I had to play. A couple of things I've learned, most importantly, no one has your best interest at heart in unless it's your own team. And I think that's a lot of the times when it's your first time doing this, you obviously have to pay to play and learn. Right. But no one is out there to, and I know this is a shitty way to look at it, but no one has your best interest at heart. And that's how important your team is. That's how important having, you know, Katrina on my team and my business partner, our business partner, Tom, and our other network of the people I consider on our team. Because, like, I would never recommend anyone sign a lease unless you were fully funded.
Yeah. Like, we weren't.
we were about 70% of the way. 80%
yeah.
of the
You're
way.
Saying that in hindsight that you would not
yeah.
recommend during radio.
Yeah, no, I think that was a little even too close for comfort for me. Because there's a lot of you know, unknown variables. Like, right, a contractor gives you a budget, the architecture team draws the plans, the contractor budgets it, and then you know. You start opening walls and there's 30% over what you thought you needed to pay. And people
right.
tell you that, but there's no real way to, you know,
to know.
Yeah. To know. Right. So, you know, back to, you know, plan for the worst and hope for the best. But yeah, we were about 70-75% funded. You know, we put our own money. So this is something that we were very committed to. And I think most of the time a lot of this goes around, like when people open restaurants, it goes the wrong way where like you just say, you get told, yeah, 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 we can do that. Yeah, 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 we can make that. Yeah, 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 we can make it beautiful. Yeah, 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 you can get the stove. And nobody like until the ninth hour tells you actually, do you need it? And it costs this much. And is there a better way to do it? But we had a really good team and, you know, we questioned everything along the way. You know, I was very fortunate to have Katrina and Tom in my corner to be like, hey, they're saying this, but it doesn't make any sense to me. Like if I was them, I'd be doing this for my own personal advantage, not ours. So like, this doesn't make sense. And to have a corner that you can kind of echo that to and say, yeah, you're right, Jenner. Like that doesn't make any sense. Maybe we should ask. That's the reason we've been so, you know, successful. Like, great. That's the reason we're still here.
Yeah.
That's why we made it through COVID. Because we really questioned everything, you know, throughout the whole process. Like
we also had my uncle and my aunt which is how I ended up in Chicago to begin with, works for a big firm and he's been an architect for a very long time. And my aunt's a designer at the same firm. And he doesn't even do like projects anymore, and they certainly don't do projects like Esme. That they do like major projects, and he was like, "No, I'm building your restaurant."
they did Maggie Daly Park,
and they do big projects.
The MCA, so they do like it's a big firm. So it was like we were really lucky to have him in our corner, being like, "Yeah, that ain't right."
Or my aunt going like, "Okay, these proposed light boxes are." It's going to be X amount and that's way too much. And then sourcing through all her connections and like just her years of vast knowledge, you know, equivalent light boxes. Or, I mean, we just were so lucky from start to finish, you know, our business partner is Jenner's childhood friends. He's a CPA. Like this is like what he does. He's a numbers guy. You know, then my family happens to be an architect and an interior designer. I mean, like, so it was so helpful, especially when you're concerned or worried or just everything's going wrong, which of course everything went wrong. So
that's how they say it takes a village for sure.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. You're lucky you had that village. So tell us, so you mentioned like the fundraising during the pandemic and that Eric gave you advice on this. What nuggets did you learn that you want to share besides like try to have all the money in, which obviously is ideal, but what did you learn along the way that you think would be helpful for other people who are in the same position? Because you're right. I mean, that's one of the things on this show that people always find the most useful in DMS about is when we talk like brass tacks and cash and like, how do you do it? Because I think that's part of the hardest part, especially during a pandemic.
You'd be surprised the amount of things. So one thing I learned is most of these things can be accomplished by yourself, right? You don't need an attorney to go file for a liquor license through the city. Do 90% of larger name restaurants do that? Yes. But that costs money, right? And a lot of $500 an hour money, right? So a lot of these small costs can be kind of, avoided if you have time to do it, right? And every inch really does add up. And I don't think most people look at their budget like that, right? To be able to save $5,000 here, $10,000 here, $2,000 there, $1,000 here, it's like the Al Pacino, quote in Any Given Sunday when he's talking about inches, right? It's like all of those small things add up, and it's like to you have to analyze it small game and big game. At the end of the day, not everyone has a job. They have a full-time job that they're working at and trying to do this at the same time. So then you have to pay for it. At some point you have to pay to play. But I do feel like most people, you should just question everything along the journey, right? Why, if it was you, would you do it that way? Could you do it differently? And I feel like most restaurants, first restaurant, are very successful because they were put under such pressure the first go around, right? They worked so hard, they scrapped, things together to make it to the finish line, and they persevered, right? And I feel like everyone's second restaurant isn't as great as the first one, because it's not the same, you're not under the same pressure. It's not the same dynamic, right? Your back wasn't up against the wall, and you had no other choice but just to make it happen. Usually you got to win, right? And you get a little cocky and you get a little overzealous, and it's like, oh yeah, we can afford to do that. Yeah, we can afford to do that. And I truly think that we've been successful, not just because of the standard and of quality of hospitality, but I think just as a business, we've been successful because we've been so inquisitive and so able to analyze everything every step of the way and really just question what was going on. And I think Eric definitely, echoed that throughout this entire process.
As part of your business model, I know there's a charitable component. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know you mentioned having the art on the walls and being able to sell that, but tell us a little bit about the give back component and how you guys put that into the business model from the beginning.
Yeah. So it always changes. So our first 3 months we were open, we just kind of had our standard Esme menu that we'll do twice a year with an artist, and use the space kind of as a gallery as such, where it's just a space for people to bring in their thing and highlight them, right? And we'll, we kind of work on we don't take a commission like most galleries would, right? And then the other two quarters of the year, we try to attach ourselves to some type of philanthropic cause. So our second menu of the year was with Paul Octavius, who's he is an artist, he's a photographer, he's a Chicago guy. He's pretty well known here. He's super talented, loves food. I've done work with him in the past, and working with him is just very fun. And so it was an easy fit. So we don't really have a rhyme or reason how these things kind of happen. It's just been this organic relationship. So we just asked Paul, hey, we're going to raise the ticket price, and obviously we want to sell your work as well, but we're going to raise the ticket price. Is there a foundation or a charitable cause that you want to pick and we'll donate to, right? So we raised, I think just around $25,000 for, No Hugs, No Slugs, which is a group on the south side of Chicago, that raises money for, the less fortunate and homeless. And just you know, we really try to like tie everything together, right? It's not just our story, but Paul's story and the reasoning and impactfulness that, you know, that he's passionate about, right? With it, which his work represents and where he's from and what his background is. And he had just recently worked with her name's Inglewood Barbie. And he just had taken photos of her for a project he was doing for her foundation. And he's like, this just makes sense. Like, I just worked with her and this, she's doing this for the right reasons and representing the right demographic. And, so yeah, that was kind of how that one, unfolded. Our current menu again is kind of back to our Esme menu where we were just highlighting a new artist and going through the motions of finding what our voice is and who we are is what the food is here. And then as I was mentioning before, our next menu is with Kitchen Possible. So again, it's a youth programming on the Inner City Kids for Chicago. I've done work with them in the past. The woman Katie Lohman, who runs it, is fantastic. And then again, we raised the ticket price an additional $25 per person. And you know, each person that comes and eats for that menu, that goes to Kitchen Possible. So it's been very fulfilling in that department. I don't feel like Katrina can tell you better than I can, but like we interviewed and talked to a lot of, you know, mm-hmm. PR representatives and other people that are in kind of the philanthropic community here, and they're like, you should just focus on the business first.
We heard that a lot, actually. So on top of everything else, when in January of 2020 we started to like interview different PR agencies, interview different branding, marketing, then people heard Jenner was opening. So people wanted to talk to us about it, maybe pitch themselves to us if they owned companies, you know, just across the board. And like, oh my goodness, aside from those whom we hired, every single person was like, you shouldn't do that. You need to focus on the food. Don't do that. Don't do that. Focus on the food. I mean, we heard it so much. And, you know, I think Jenner and I are both the personality of like, we're stubborn and you know, we say thank you very much for your opinion and don't make people feel bad, but we're like, yeah, we're totally going to do that. So, and then with the civil unrest, I remember that May going like, oh no, now I'm really going to do this. Like, I knew we wanted to do this, but now we're really going to do this. This is what we need to do to positively contribute to our city and positively contribute to other people. Like, we felt so strongly about that, you know? And at the end of the day, you learn from example, right? People are led by example. And if you've had the opportunity to have good examples, you're just going to do things because that's what you know. And that's what Jenner and I knew. I mean, we both came from MK Restaurant. We both, you know, worked with Michael and Lisa Kornick. Eric Williams was the executive chef there. They're all very important to us in our lives. We got married in one of Michael and Lisa's restaurants, you know. Eric is the one who set us up. He married us. He is one of the most important people in our lives. And, you know, one of the things that was always taught to us, imagine, I would say we grew up in this restaurant, was that you give back. Like, if you're fortunate, you give back, period, the end. Like, whether it was finishing an event with Eric and then going back to the restaurant, taking anything that was extra at the restaurant, and then going and finding, you know, a homeless shelter or a women's shelter. And then, I mean, I'm talking after you'd worked all day and you're exhausted, it's the middle of the night, and dropping off the food to these people who needed it, or whether it was raising money, selling pies, or whether it was, you know, watching Eric, and I think he still does this, go in, he cooks turkey for the homeless every Thanksgiving. Like, you know, Michael and Lisa were very adamant about supporting causes and being generous as also just as restaurateurs, as our employers. They were just generous. It's, you know, it's why I ended up with a full-time job and still was hostessing twice a week. I didn't want to leave. It was very difficult for me to leave them. And you know, that to us, when you see this and when you watch Eric, you know, I've heard, like, you know, how it is, the gossipy gossips around town going like, oh, this seems very similar to Virtue. Are they copying Eric? We're not copying him, but we're doing what he showed us to do and what he has advised us. And we will always do that. He is such a leader in this industry, and he has art on his walls, and he supports local artists, and he takes his time and takes his son to go feed the homeless. I'm going to take my son because Eric does that. You know what I mean? And that's how we've built this. We're hoping to build this restaurant, hoping to impact the community in ways that we saw Michael, Lisa, and Eric impact them. And they impacted our lives. And, you know, that's just, I said to Jenner the other day, like, this is just how we do things. We do it like the Cornix and Eric had done them. And that's how we do it at Esme. You know, we were talking about something that involved an employee. And I'm like, well, this is just how we take care of them. That's what we were taught. Right. And I think that that's really how all of this came to be, us talking about like, yeah, we could just open a restaurant, and really thinking about like, why did we love working at MK and for these people? Like, why? We would talk about that a lot. And it was because they were good people and they taught us very valuable lessons. And so when people are like, this is reminiscent of something Eric Williams is doing, I'm always like, it sure is, because we talk to him about everything we do. And he tells us, this is what I'm doing, or we just see it. And you model people that you look up to that help raise you, you're going to model their behavior. And that's the biggest testament you can give to them. So I think when we started this whole thing, we knew we wanted something philanthropic. We knew we wanted to give back. We had to make a decision when Jenner left Next, like, what are we going to do? Do we stay here? Do we leave? What do we do? What are we doing with our lives? And we both said, we want to remain in Chicago. We love Chicago. And then the next question was like, okay, but like, how do we give back to Chicago? How? And then that's kind of where we landed.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's, you know, it's, we talk, this comes up a lot on the show, is like working for good people and then using what they taught you to also give back and do good. And I'm curious, you know, because like fine dining and, you know, tasting menus and, you know, intricate plating and all these beautiful things that you put on the plate also have a reputation for being wasteful and not sustainable. So how do you, like, being so mission driven and so value driven, how do you reconcile those two, and what do you do to make sure that you're not being wasteful and those kind of things while driving this beautiful tasting menu?
You know, it's everyone has a cause and a mission, and I don't it's very hard to be on every, to go along with everything, right? And I think what we've tried to do is identify what is the most important to us and what that looks like. And be passionate about that, right? It's very like the media upkeep on like what the next, you know, thing is so overwhelming, right? So we've just always tried to stick to our, you know, what we've learned and what we learned that we didn't enjoy about growing up in the restaurant industry. And that's what we're going to stick to, right? We try to produce at the highest level and give hospitality at the highest level. And I think for us, we've been successful because a lot of the times, the reason of the mission stops getting told, right? And I'll relate this to cooking, and particularly just, you know, the hierarchy of the kitchen, right? You know, you see, you've worked in, you know, restaurants of this caliber, it's, it can be quiet, can be somewhat militant. You know, it can look as some type of hierarchy, you know, like the army or however you want to frame it, right? Those things make you very efficient and very organized, and those are the positive things that come out with it. The negative that comes out of it, it's very hard to maintain staffing, your, you know, personal and own mental health. So those are the things that we're always kind of been conscious about. And I feel like continuing to have a message to why we're doing this is kind of alleviated a lot of the negative aspects of it. Are we exhausted? Yes. Or is this seem like it's never ending? Yes. But in the same sense, it's fulfilling. You know, we're not trying to be the best restaurant in the world. You know, that is not our goal. Our goal is not to win awards. Are those things validating and great? Yes. Am I going to turn one down? No, because it's going to put butts in seats, and that's great. But I'm not doing this to be the next tasting menu. That's not why we've decided to do this. I like the creative aspect of this, and I like that we've created space for others and that just doesn't mean the artists on the wall, but I mean, I'm in our team, right? And to continue to tell that mission and tell that story of why we're doing this, how and why we function, how and why our standards are the way they are. You know, it's not this, don't slam the oven door or I'm going to yell at you. It's, hey, if you continue to slam the oven door and don't take ownership of the space, then we won't have an oven, because the oven's the most important part of the kitchen, and the door is what determines if that piece of equipment is functional or not. And if you continue to slam it, it's going to stop working, right? And the bottom line of a restaurant looks like this. This is how many covers we do, and this is what our costs are. There's not room, much room for error. And that conversation is usually lost, right? That conversation between owner and management and hourly employees, top to bottom. And I felt like we've tried to be as transparent as possible through this entire like journey. And it's been very beneficial for us.
And I do think that, like, while let's say our mission isn't like, let's be the most, let's, we're really just going to do have minimal waste. Like, it, like you said, it, fine dining is very, that's, it's very much known for waste. What we have done is, and what Jenner's talking about as well, is like this education component. And we actually had a cook who's actually very passionate about waste, and like Jenner, and he like brought it up, and Jenner was like, awesome. I will charge you with writing a plan. With, we can learn the inventory, we can learn this, and let's, you know, we try to uplift people enough if they're passionate about something that is something that we can implement, right? And we can start working on. And we also open the bar knowing that, you know, a lot of whatever's happening in the bar is specifically based on the dining room, right? So we do a lot of the overage that is coming out of our dining room tasting menu is what's being produced in the bar, which is helpful. And then it's just a matter of, like Jenner say, we try to be very transparent with people. We try to, you know, if someone's really into something, really passionate about something, we try to give individuals the space to implement that, make it their own, and possibly change how we're structured and what we're doing. So, you know, while we're, of course, everyone thinks about wastefulness or not wastefulness, or things are trying to minimize waste. While it's not maybe our, like, this is who we are and this is what we do, there are these smaller aspects, like Jenner's saying, like through the education, when you're explaining to someone why inventory is so important. Well, wrong inventory could lead to greater waste. So if you're teaching these skills and you're allowing people to look at P&Ls, look at inventory lists, you know, speaking to them about the numbers and why it's important not to over order, you know, bathroom toiletries for the guest, or, you know, all these different things, it then translates into that reduction of waste down the line. And you also help someone learn, right? And that's a lesson they can take into their own house or if they open their own business. And I think that those have been the biggest things that we've done, are just, you know, we knew we wanted this bar, pushing over some of that overage over to the bar side, and then just really trying to educate. And if someone is passionate about something, rather than being like, listen, we're really busy doing all these other things, saying, awesome, how can we support you to spearhead this? Like, you know, because it can be very overwhelming. There are a lot of very good and positive causes that we all need to be made aware of. It's just sometimes
you can't do it all. You got to
focus. Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's, I think everybody, you know, everybody appreciates that. It's like, you can't solve all the world's problems.
Exactly.
You got to focus on the small, focus on what you put your foot in front of you and do that really well.
Exciting news for restaurants. Bento Box and Clover have teamed up to provide even more technology for a better hospitality experience.
With over 70% of diners researching restaurants online before they go in person, a strong digital presence is more important than ever.
Bento Box's website, marketing tools, and commerce platform help restaurants get discovered online, make more money, and engage diners in person and virtually.
And Clover's world-class POS and payment system streamlines daily operations for a totally seamless experience.
With Bento Box and Clover working together, restaurants now have an all-in-one solution that makes it easy to deliver better hospitality from the kitchen to tableside and beyond.
Bento Box and Clover,
the right recipe for hospitality.
Visit getbento.com/better to learn more.
That's getbento.com/BETTER.
Al, should we go into order fire?
Let's do it. I'll kick it off. What is your favorite menu item?
Katrina, you do the tasting menu. I'll do the bar.
No, I want to do the bar.
sounds like the bars.
I just know what he's gonna say. Mine is the pierogi. The broth on the tasting menu side for the pierogi, which is actually a constant during our essay menus. Oh my god, it's like the most delicious French onion soup broth that you've ever had, but like 10 times better. So good.
I'll give you details on what it is. I know, coming from a long line of great cooks, but my mom didn't cook, but my grandmother made a couple things. And I spent a lot of time with her. She made chicken and dumplings, which is near and dear to my heart. And then pierogies. So this isn't what she did, but it's a feeling and emotion that I think is comforting and warm to think about. So I wanted to recreate that. So it's a single pierogi in a bowl. It's been filled with raclette cheese. We smother it with a bunch of winter or summer truffle, depending on the time of the year. And then we pour a broth of burnt onions. So we like basically carbonize red onions on the grill for a long time, almost till it's like charcoal. And then we steep it in water. So it's like tea. And it takes like 48 hours to kind of make this broth. And it comes out very veal stock like in quality, even though it's vegetarian. And like Katrina was saying, it's definitely like burnt onion soup.
So good.
Sounds delicious. So is that also your favorite, Jenner, or no?
On the tasting menu, yeah, that's probably one I like to talk about the most. And then the bar, we have a giant Cheeto, which is fun. We serve a smaller, in more intricate, one bite in the tasting menu. And then in the bar, it's just this giant flaming hot Cheeto. We bought a grain extruder. So we actually make them in house.
You didn't buy it. You made the grain extruder.
we bought the extruder. And then one of my dear friends who helped us open the restaurant, him and his dad, like, it had to be attached to like a 10 horsepower motor. And then they welded a frame for it, and mounted it. And basically you hook up the extruder to a flywheel and then to the motor. And then it basically like a meat grinder. If anyone is listening, you know, has ground like large quantities of meat out of a Hobart, but rather than, so there's a die. And then rather than at the front of the extruder, there's would normally be like a hole and a blade for things to come out. This is just capped and has a small hole out of the front of it. So basically what you're happening is creating pressure and heat. And then like thermal dynamics comes into play of the rapid drop in temperature, and pressure. And it causes the grain to actually like explode or puff. So we do that all in house, and then we toss it in a bunch of fermented chilies and orange cheddar powder, and some citric acid, because that's like the very nostalgic flaming hot flavor, if you ask me. It's fun. It makes a terrible
mess,
but yeah, the guests love it.
How many flaming hot Cheetos do you sell at the bar?
It's usually like every guest that comes in gets it.
I saw it on your Instagram. It did look pretty cool. I'm not going to lie.
It's like if you go to a bar and you're like, there's bar nuts on the menu, like everyone gets the bar nuts to nibble on while you pick a cocktail. It's kind of like that. It's a pain in the ass because you have to dehydrate it, and it's massive and it takes up a ton of room. So, but it's worth it.
Well, that was sort of answering our next question, which was your most ordered menu item, which I assume now is the Flaming Hot Cheeto.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Al, you want to do the next one?
Sure. What's the – I'll be curious to hear if it's Flaming Hot Cheeto again. What's your best food cost item?
Yes, that.
Yes?
Yes, that.
I guess if you eliminate labor costs.
Yeah. And then probably the tartare, the Wagyu tartare that we have on the menu. We always try to have byproduct. So if we're running a crudo of some sort, on the tasting menu, there's always byproduct, right? So I guess it depends on how you look at it. We're not buying steaks to run on the bar menu. It's just a byproduct of the tasting menu. So it's always a way to kind of reduce costs, whether, you know, we're using the physical eye of the ribeye in the dining room, and then we use the cap for steaks in the bar, and then any byproduct that isn't like a perfect portion gets cut into tartare.
Cool. What about how do you plan to, how do you hire and retain great employees?
I will say one thing about that is that every generation, I feel like, has always said it's impossible to hire good employees. And I think this isn't a new thing. I don't think COVID is, it has been necessarily the biggest, problem to hiring people. I think it's just spotlighted an issue that has been going on for forever, right? It's an industry issue. If you go to different industries, it's probably been an issue at that. It's really on the onus of the owner and the manager. And it's not about finding qualified and experienced people, but it's about finding people that believe in what you're trying to achieve and then taking the time and the effort to
work with them,
grow them, and find what their strengths are and lean into those things. You know, they're not working for us. We're working for them.
Yeah. I always say skills can be taught, passion and a good attitude can't. So, we can teach people skills. We've definitely hired people who've never worked in Michelin restaurants, don't know how to pour wine. That can be taught, but they're dynamic. They're eager. They want to work. They're happy to be there. They're excited. That can't be taught, right? I can't teach that. If you bring someone who's excited to be in your space and believes in what you're doing, that's basically kind of our motto and how we, hire and then also retain.
Makes sense. Tell us, aside from the liquor license and the Black Iron, worst building or your developing story?
Worst? Oh my God, the tables. The tables. That was another time I cried a lot. I actually left my house. I'm not going to lie. I left the house because I couldn't even be in the same space as Jenner or any human individual. I left him with a newborn and I went on a run. And I was like, I'm just going to run. I don't know where I'm running to, but like everyone needs to leave me alone. Oh, my, that was horrible. Go ahead, Jenner. You can tell the story.
So the tables and the chairs. So they picked the designer of his aunt. They both have expensive tastes.
Me and my aunt, apparently. Apparently this is my fault, but go ahead.
So they designed a beautiful space and we had to work within a budget. So we worked on, minimizing what costs were and accents were and doing the best to keep the initial intent. So we have cement tables. So there are these white cement tables that each, like the two top weighs like 300 pounds, right? they're extremely heavy, right? But they're beautiful. They're white. They've been stained with sand from Lake Michigan. So the initial idea was to find cement, or find these tables and get them shipped here. And I'm like, why are we doing this? Why are we buying cement from California and shipping it to Chicago? I was like, there's gotta be someone who makes this stuff here. Right. And the same thing.
And then
thing
we need a table base. The table bases were also intricate.
Yeah, the table bases they had picked out were these branch table bases. They like it looks like a tree branch, right? It has one solid base and then it branches up into like four or five posts. And they were from Italy and they were beautiful. And I'm like, why can't we find someone here to make this? So we did. We ended up finding two very talented individuals. This Chicago Concrete and Bucktown built the wooden table bases. But the problem was it coming together. So like 2 weeks before, 2 weeks before we were supposed to open, we got the cement delivered. And then the next week we got the table bases delivered and we were going to have the cement guys attach them to the bases. And each person basically said, hey, once they got together, like, This table can't go on that base and this base can't go on that table because they didn't want to be liable for it not working because they did the math wrong and the tabletop was too heavy for the base and vice versa. So we end up having to find cast iron bases to reattach to the base, the wooden base. And then again, our good friend that helped us build the Cheetah machine.
And his dad.
Him and his dad came in and we were up like for 48 hours drilling table bases into concrete.
They were doing table bases until the hour before we opened the doors for our first night of friends and family. Like we didn't know what we were going to do. We had no tables. We had a restaurant. The restaurant was going to open. Friends and family invitations had gone out. tickets had been purchased and we had no tables. And we didn't know what we were going to do. And like the only other option would have been like to get really ugly black tables. So I was having a complete and utter meltdown. Like I was just losing my mind. Yeah. God bless Jake and his dad. Because and then they were like, Jake was taking it from one place to the other. My uncle was calling engineers. Like it was just, oh yeah. It was exactly what you would expect to happen when you're opening a restaurant. It's exactly what should happen. That's what happens when you open restaurants.
Yeah. Unpredictable. But yes. People got fed on tables for opening night.
Yes. And everything worked out and they're beautiful. And we love to tell the story about the branches and then the beautiful sand from Lake Michigan. And we just never tell the fact that literally we were in big trouble.
I love it. All right, cool. Al, you want to wrap us up?
Sure. Why don't you guys tell us where we can find you on social and online?
My Instagram's Jenner Tomaska, JennerTomaska, and then K Bravo. What's your Instagram?
K Bravo. What's that? You know, that's a good question. I just look up Katrina Bravo, and you'll find me. there's very few of me.
And the restaurant Instagram is Esme _ Chicago.
Perfect.
Yeah, mine has a lot more baby content, so I don't know how many of your listeners want to see Roman on a daily basis, but.
You never know. Cool. We are opening soon and at Till It NYC. Thank you guys for sharing the story. We're very excited to hear it and looking forward to a meal in the restaurant.
Come eat, please.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, yes. Come on in. Thank you for having
Thanks,
us. Guys.
Thanks for having us.
Opening Soon is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.